I'm very pleased to welcome back to Fremantle Shipping News, Dave Warner. Welcome back, Dave.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. It's really nice to be back.
And here we are in the West End of Fremantle. It means something to you.
Absolutely. We're at the moment where we're sitting to record this interview would be 100 metres from where I spent almost every weekend of my youth from the age of 5 to 16, something like that, because my grandparents had the first floor flat in the McElraiths building, which is just two buildings from here. And so I was imbued with Fremantle life. My dad was a butcher and he worked really long hours and stuff, and I think you know, those were in the days. My mum was a stay-at-home mum, but she'd be chopping the kindling wood, and you know, the old days, you'd stoke up the boiler and do all those sorts of things.
I thought that'd be your job, Dave.
Well, perhaps it should have been, but I was too young early on, and then I think by the time that I attained the age of that I should be doing that, I think they had sophisticated things like oil heaters or something, you know.
You're backing out.
yeah. But, you know, this is... And I wrote a song, Vignettes, which was specifically about this particular area and my memories of Fremantle. And it's got a... You know, we used to play by the railway tracks. And so out the back of where we are, there's a little... I think even then it was disused, the railway track there, but, you know, good sort of place to play. Plenty of drunks around Fremantle at that time, and His Majesty's always a brawl going on at His Majesty's. And so I recollected listening to the sounds of Inspector West on the big valve radio with my grandparents, and then you'd hear the, as the drunks staggered from the His Majesty's Hotel, you'd hear a big bottle of beer dropped and smashed on the footpath.
I think it might be the Department of Nursing in Notre Dame today.
Well, very appropriate.
Now, Dave, I'm just going to mention a guy's name and ask, does he have any connection with Fremantle? Frank Zappa. And, of course, the mothers of invention.
Yeah, well, he certainly does with me. I discovered Frank Zappa through reading pop magazines and books, because in the 1960s, if you were really dedicated to music and underground music, as it was called, the records of the artists only got here probably 6 months, you know, after they were released, and certainly you never heard them on commercial radio, and for a long time not even on the ABC. And so I had read about this band, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, who were really weird and crazy. And so for my 15th birthday, which was 1968, and in fact was on, my birthday was on the day of the Meckering earthquake, which flattened a whole part of Perth and the town of Meckering. And so nobody paid any attention to my birthday, but I had my two albums, which was I Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die by Country Jive and the Fish, and We're Only In It for the Money, Frank Zappa. I think it was We're Only In It for the Money. Could have been absolutely free. It was one of those ones. And my grandmother, I'd given her a list, so she'd gone up to Voxadian in Perth and found the albums for me, so at least I had those to play on my turntable while everybody else watched the disaster unfold on TV.
What an amazing connection. I remember discovering Frank Zappa and thinking he seemed anything but a musician, just a really interesting person playing stuff.
Yeah.
And the Mothers of Invention, I mean, names of bands, they were something of inventions themselves.
Well, they were, yeah, Peanut Butter Conspiracy, etc. But Frank Zappa had a quite profound influence. Frank Zappa and a band called The Fugs on my whole approach to music, because they were very anti-everything. I mean, they weren't just anti-establishment. I mean, Frank was also kind of anti the rock and roll reviewers and journalists in the papers. And I think, what did he say about rock magazines? He was hard to get an interview, and he said, you know, he said rock interviews are for people who can't read by people who can't write.
Well, that's the way to get on with the media.
I liked his cynicism and the Fugs too, and that imbued the creation of my first band, Puss, which was probably Australia's first punk band, certainly a proto-punk band in 73, 74.
Just Puss with a single S.
Yeah, just with a single S, yes. And at that time, I wanted to grab the attention of things. And so we played a few gigs around the place. But a big influence was Frank Zappa. And the way that I was actually saying, I did a little library talk last night, and I'll be doing them for a while in Perth. But a lot of musicians, the influences are kind of musical influences. So they hear AC/DC or Led Zeppelin or whatever. And whereas mine was a more conceptual influence. So I listened to people like the Fugs and Frank Zappa, and the way that they were kind of interpreting the world through different styles of music. Didn't, you know, like Zappa did 50s crooning stuff with Reuben and the Jets. He did wild jazz sounding stuff, pop stuff.
Grappelli gets mentioned.
Yeah. So, and I really liked that idea that you could take any kind of musical form and fit it to, and in my case, my the central tenet of my music was suburban life. So Dave Warner's from the suburbs, suburban boy, suburban rock. But all the time while I was doing that, you know, my other musical influences too was I was sitting in my room in Bicton at that time, or sometimes up here in Fillmore Street, were bands like The Doors and, well, I've got my, specifically, people can't see this, but I'm wearing my Janis Joplin Cheap Thrills t-shirt imported from France.
Janis has her own chapter in the book we're going to talk about.
Well, she does. She's a very, you know, she's a very major player in the book, and it didn't actually start out that way necessarily. But then once I got into it, I found that Janis Joplin made a very good sparring partner and potential love interest for Ray Shearer, who's one of my cops. He's a sort of, Ray's a quite a tough, corrupt cop, but he does have his own moral ethos that he ascribes to, but he certainly doesn't believe in that petty infractions such as taking money for overlooking a minor
or shooting someone dead.
Yes, he doesn't believe any of that should apply to police. You know,
he has a good offsider, John Gordon.
Yeah,
he's a bit straighter.
Yeah, John Gordon's much straighter. He's the younger one, and I first introduced them in a book called Big Bad Blood in 1965, and they were cops in Sydney, and John Gordon had just started, so he was the ingenue cop who wanted to do the right thing, and yeah, he was proud of the uniform, and Ray Shearer had been around a bit, and Ray was the SP and bagman for the main criminal of King's Cross, George Shalhoub. So I really loved that book. It was a big, complex book, Big Bad Blood, probably the most complex that I've plotted.
Can I say, I love the book. If people haven't read Big Bad Blood, 1997, won all the prizes, it's a hell of a read.
Oh, great, Michael. Yeah, look, I loved it. It's a real favourite of mine, and I've only, after having it languished for some time, I've only recently got it back in print. I had it for a while where people could download it, and one of the reasons for doing that was because in this most recent book, as I said, they, after a 20-odd year hiatus, they've returned. And I really wanted to bring them back for a long time. I thought, that, you know, they're a couple of great characters. And the style, the writing style in this book is different. It was very influenced by James Ellroy, the LA writer. Very punchy, muscular sentences, very short sentences, drop a lot of verbs or adjectives that you didn't feel that you needed. And the reason I did that initially was when I was doing Big Bad Blood in 1965, I thought that the kind of tough, corrupt element of King's Cross needed a different style to what I'd used for my first book, City of Light, which was set in Perth, which is more laid back. It's kind of...
Perth?
Yeah, it's Perth, you know. So I adopted that style. So I thought, well, if I'm bringing these characters back, I should write it in that style. And
it works.
Yeah, great.
And the book, just so everybody knows doubly, that we're talking about is Summer of Blood. And that's 1967. So Ray and John get up to all that strife in 65 in Big Bad Blood.
Yeah.
In this book, they're back into it all in 1967. I've only got one real bone to pick with you. A great detective, Mike Barker, doesn't get the ticket to San Francisco or Los Angeles to take part in all of this, Dave. What happened there?
Yeah, well, this is... I think I love that era so much, being a schoolboy, going to Christian Brothers College and living a very straight, you know, tight life. My friends and I, we would pore over the magazines and the readings and look at the guys in girls in San Francisco and think, wow, how would it be to be at Haight Ashbury? And so when I sort of always wanted to bring these characters back, and I've always had a hankering to do something, some book, some story that was set around that time, just because it was so personal to me. And I had this idea of putting the two things together, and I thought, I was on a holiday with my old pus guitarist Nick Geronimus in Greece, and that must have given me the time to think about things. And I thought, oh, Ray and John, what if I brought them to America in 1967? And the benefits that had is, one, I loved that era, I loved that music. But the other thing was that I thought it was such a kind of opposite world, you know, so completely different to the world, that fairly straight world of tough guys and racehorses and corrupt jockeys and things in Sydney in 65, that there would be fun in putting them into that world. And you know, and I think there is fun.
There is fun, and one has to honour the proverbial book review, even though we're sort of podcasting it, and tell people what happens in the book. So I'm reading from the back cover, Dave. May 1967, a young Australian student has gone missing in San Francisco. Sent to find him, DS John Gordon and CI Ray Shearer follow leads through a maze of love-ins, nightclubs and backstage parties. It does sound like everybody's schoolboy's dream. But their Californian dreaming starts to feel like a bad acid trip when they discover that the missing Australian was hunting a serial killer. And now it's up to them to finish the job. Well, pleased to report they do, but you're going to have to read this book because it's non-stop. But strangely, it took me a couple of chapters to realise, because I never read the contents page in books, Dave, that chapter one, Tales of Brave Ulysses, chapter two, California Dreamin', chapter three, San Francisco, chapter four, The Golden Road to Unlimited Devotion, and on and on and on we go, right down to chapter 31, A Whiter Shade of Pale. So how did you go about selecting all of these fabulous music titles for the book, and they all had to be current?
Yeah, well, they were all 67, or yes, exactly, they were all being played in 67, some were 66. There might have been one that might have been after this book. I tried to give it as much veracity as I could, but I did cheat a bit with the title. So I was looking for songs that might have a theme or in some way encapsulate something that happened in a chapter. And there are a few where that actually...
It does
happen.
Yes.
The others, I just thought, oh, look, this could be fun to do this. And so I will use it, you know. And I would have liked to have quoted a lot more lyrics from the songs too in parts. And I did in the initial draft, but the song publishers wanted too much money for them. And I, you know, so couldn't do it just being
It's a crazy part of the law, isn't it? People's copyright reproduction. You'd think most people would be pleased to have the lyrics of their song laid out, and people say, well, that sounds interesting, I'll go and listen to it, and they'll get some royalties, perhaps only a few on Spotify.
Exactly. I would have thought 50 years on, especially, look, I can understand if an author's doing a book that's a non-fiction book about those people and you're quoting the lyrics for the songs, you might be using that in order to sell the book in a way. Even then, I think, you know, you'd go, yes. But in a fictional book where the lyrics are being used to reinforce a passage, I'm with you, Michael. I would think people would go, oh, that would be great. And there were some really good parts there. And More Again was one of the ones I really wanted to use, because there's a point where the two cops are trying to find this missing girl who could be the key to the whole mystery, which is why the young Australian guy's gone missing, because he thinks this girl's been abducted. And we don't know for most of the book, is she abducted and dead? Is she alive? You know, is she somehow involved in this whole story? And they're in a place, and everywhere they look, is that her? That's not her. And there were some great lyrics from the love song And More Again, you know, and if you see And More Again, then you can find And More Again. And I thought they would have fitted perfectly, and I had them initially, but I had to take them out. But anyway, such is life. It still worked. And the other point, while we're on that and trying to get the veracity, was that As you say, they decide, look, the place we're going to find this guy, we're going to have to go to where all the bands are playing, because that's where we're likely to get a lead on where he might be. And in doing so, they actually they go to a number of different shows in different places in California. Some are in Los Angeles and some are in San Francisco. But every one of those concerts, except one, was a concert that actually happened. So if Ray and John are at the Fillmore and Country Joe and the Fishers launching Electric Music for Mind and Body and Janis Joplin's topping the bill, or vice versa, that show actually happened. If they go to the Hollywood Bowl and Buffalo Springfield was playing.
It's just fantastic. And so you can have been a 13 or a 14-year-old kid living in Bicton while all of that was happening over there. But you can come back to it and you can research it and you can feel it and you can play the music, and there's probably a little bit of film still around the place, is there, of some of those concerts?
Oh, yeah, there's quite a bit of film at that time. And, and these characters are looking for people who, you know, who might be making some film, because for a serial killer,
it becomes very important.
Yeah, they're thinking they might be able to find some. And there were quite a lot, and a lot of British filmmakers went over and shot stuff, because it was also involved very much in the incipient anti-war movement, anti-Vietnam War. So a lot of stuff that was happening in Berkeley, California, which was probably the heart of that whole anti-war movement.
I wanted to raise that broad question with you, because I think people did realise pretty quickly, didn't they, that this was, you know, a cultural revolution that was going on. We didn't have Chairman Mao, but we had everything that was happening there. What do you make of that era? What did you sort of come out with after you'd finished the book and immersed yourself in the era and brought yourself back to Australia circa 2020?
I still find that it's, you know, how do you make anything of it? I can't say that I had any concrete things, but certainly that era in the 60s was the first time that you had a very large proportion of young people who were able to affect political and social change. Now, what happened to them? Greg McCain from Skyhooks had a great song in the 70s, "Whatever Happened to the Revolution?" Because, you know, most of us who went along there still ended up, they went to uni and got jobs and got degrees and went off and teaching.
Wrote music and became screenwriters and
exactly,
wrote books.
Exactly, and did all that sort of thing. But I think, I do think that there was, you know, people talk a lot these days about social responsibility, and I think there's no doubt that that was all present. And people like Phil Oakes, who I'm a huge fan of, you know, they were very, John Lennon, you know, they were very vocal about this idea, which is it's actually a kind of very Christian idea of everything for everybody, and you know, and not for the few, and also preserving our world, you know, how it in a pristine manner. And then you had people like Frank Zappa, who were very outspoken about what was in those days called the industrial military complex,
and it still is,
and that's the point that I was getting to, is that hasn't that sort of come back right back into focus? So you're talking, you know, 60 years or whatever, and now boom, we're back again with people still with the same, raising the same things.
Well, in our day, when we were younger, the word Marxist got thrown around. You don't hear it quite so much at the moment. The place where Marxism used to do well, Russia, has got its own particular way of approaching things. But of all of those different bands, did you fall in love with any of them, having researched and reminded yourself of the music and walked away saying, geez, I didn't know I loved them so much?
Look, I don't know. Partly, I played the electric keyboard, so partly I always loved The Doors and Country Joe and the Fish, because they were major factors. I liked, I was always in love with Country Joe, and I think partly I did like the fact that he kind of could do a social message in a fun way, but he could, his next song could be a very lyrical or romantic song as well. So he wasn't, I guess a band like Midnight Oil, for example, almost defined by a very declamatory thing on every song that they did, and I liked
Country Joe in that he could do that, but it wasn't an obsession over all his music. And Zappa, we've talked about, I loved. Janis Joplin, I just still gives me chills when I hear her singing, and her tragic life, like a lot of other great female singers through the era. So, and with Janis, I was pleased to be able to kind of try and get intimate with her in a way with Ray and try and form a connection. Now, I have this feeling that had my fictional thing happened, I guess I wouldn't have written it otherwise, but I do have a feeling they could really have got on.
It's a lovely idea. You say in some notes you hope that she wouldn't have minded the characterisation of her that you provided. Look, it sort of got me. I wanted to go back in time and go there. I haven't spent any time to speak of in LA, but I love San Francisco. It would have been a great place to be in the summer of 67. Now, you've gone to other places in your writing. You've been Perth-based, as you say, Sydney-based, and you've been up the North Coast from memory.
Yeah.
River of Salt.
Yes, correct.
Great book. Love that book. And you've been in New York. You've been on Manhattan. How do you research these things? Do you have to go on a tax-deductible holiday for a...
I did on... in Manhattan, Over My Dead Body, which was my one about Sherlock Holmes and Georgette Watson, the great-great-granddaughter of John Watson.
It's very clever, that book.
Good. Yeah, look, I've really enjoyed it. And it came from a screenplay that I wrote, but I had not been to New York since 1986. And so fortuitously in 2019 Christmas, I went there and I took the family there and had a look around because despite the research that I was doing, I just couldn't find certain things as to whether they made sense or not, geographically, could that still be the case? And so I actually went there. And we were very fortunate. We came back on New Year's Day and just missed the outbreak of COVID in New York by a couple of weeks. But that one, I really did need to go there. Some of the other, it's not so bad when you're setting things in the past because, you can play a little bit here and there with things. Some of the things, my memory's good enough that I don't need to chase up too much. Some of the ones in the Northwest, it's really funny with research, like trying to research stuff on the Gibb River Road. And I've been on the Gibb River Road, but I've never done that whole journey on the Gibb River Road. I've never been up to the Mitchell Plateau. And you can try and find it online and it's just completely contradictory what people say. And it was a little bit like that with Manhattan too. I'd contact people and I'd say, look, what do you think? Would there be a three-story walk-up place in, this part of Manhattan? Oh, no, not there. Then the next person would say, oh, of course, So I thought I'll go and have a look for myself.
Very wise.
Yeah.
So this book's out. It's doing the rounds. You're here. And it's lovely that you bring music to your book. Have you got some music that accompanies your talks?
Yeah, I have. One of the things that I started doing, it'd be about 15 years ago now, when I the very first library talk that I ever did was for Subiaco Library. And Susan, who was the main librarian there, was great. She was a real spark. And she got us in and said, look, would you like to do something with your books? Or what? And I said, could I do something maybe with some books and add some music, talk about the interconnection? And she said, yeah. And that's really where it started. So I tour whenever I can. I don't have to tour with Tony Durant, my guitarist, long time compatriot. We've been playing together for over 50 years, but it is fun to do it. And it breaks up the idea of doing long, reading long passages or just talking. I might talk for 3 or 4 minutes, for example, about a book like River of Salt, which, as you say, was set up in northern New South Wales, southern Queensland, and set in 1963. And the idea for that book almost came when I walked down to see my mate Martin Cilia, who plays with legendary Australian surf band The Atlantics. And I heard the music, and it threw me back into that era. So not only can we talk about it, we then go and play a song that I wrote for that book. And
I'm forgetting about the music for that book. Yeah.
Yeah, and we wrote a song for this book too. Summer of Blood, and we do that little single, Summer of Blood. I have to send you a copy if you haven't got one, Michael, so yeah.
It's interesting, you keep taking me back to 67, 68 and those years and where we got our music from. In Perth it was 6KY or 6PR.
6PR,
they were
guys.
A bit barrack for one or the other, a bit like you supported East Fremantle or South Fremantle, yeah. But you couldn't support both. And then the ABC came along and you had people like Peter Holland,
yeah.
and later Dave Allery, yeah. playing music. I mean, the first time I think I heard the Eagles played was Dave Allery, and you had yeah. Earl Reeve playing late music. I rang Earl Reeve once upon a time and said, oh, you know, what about Mickey Newbury? You know, he said, how do you know about Mickey Newbury? And started playing some music. But the radio station's where we got a lot of our music, Dave.
Absolutely. And as you say, I did mention them in the acknowledgements of the book too, because people like Peter Holland, Dave Allery, they were really important to me. And some of the musicians who were just that little half a generation ahead of me, Dennis James, who, you know, East Fremantle supporter, good on you, Dennis, and who lives in America now. He played in many, many bands over the years. Johnny Johnson, my great mate, who lived up the road in Beach Street in Bicton. They were heroes of mine, and it was kind of like a very tight and small community. Probably like many years later, the punk community was, in a way, where you know everybody wanted to be in on the happening thing and knew that. Al Cash, drummer, who's American, great drummer, loads of bands. So yeah, all those people were important to me, and especially in a place, this little outpost, Perth, you know. We were reliant on them to hear new sounds. And I was just saying to my mate who I'm staying with, Michael, we were both the same thing. We'd, you know, those days you didn't have cell phones or anything. And late at night when you'd be listening, well, late at night was probably read 10 p.m. or something, you're sitting there when you're supposed to have gone to bed listening to the Peter Holland playing something, and you'd remember the bands, and you'd come the next day to school and you'd say, oh, did you hear Climax Chicago Blues Band? Yeah. Who was the band that he played after that? You know, oh, Pentangle. So you had all these, you know, different musical influences. So it was great. It actually was underground in a way.
Coming back to your writing, have we got something on the boil?
Yeah, I've got a few, quite a lot on the boil actually. So I've already completed my next novel that will come out in October via Fremantle Press, When It Rains, which will be Dan Clement is my Kimberley detective. It will be the fourth in that series. And that's, this time it's set up around primarily Kununurra, but still Broome, so East Kimberley region. Then the next year, 25, I haven't finished the editing process, but I'm well into a book that is completely different to that. It's set in 1929 in England, and originally the working title was Willful Murder. I think we're going to call it Of Sound Mind and Dead Body. But many years ago, before, about 1983 to be precise, before I did any crime writing or writing, I had this idea with my mate Dave Zampatti. I'd started reading Agatha Christie books, and I'd read them all, and I loved them. And I said, wouldn't it be fun to do a play where it actually involved and unfolded around the audience, and we could make it an Agatha Christie-style play? And so I wrote up a plot and timed it. I had to time it so people in the... We did over a weekend at Cave's house in Yelling Up, and so people could see someone coming in one door and out the other door, and they could actually be live and present when the murder was happening and get clues from the various conversations that characters had in set pieces over the course of the weekend. So it was really writing that play that made me feel that I could write a plot and sustain a plot. And what I've done really for the book that will come out the following year, as I say, I think it's going to be called Of Sound Mind and Dead Body, is that it's actually that play reworked with an Australian hero, but it's 1929, it's in England, and we have an Australian detective as the equivalent of Hercule Poirot.
Well, that'll...
So that's that, and then I've got lots of other stuff. I've got a Bollywood musical that I'm writing and hoping to get out somewhere or other, and a few other ideas.
Look, I love your creative enthusiasm. I love how you never seem to stop. What is it that keeps you going like this? You're going in a number of different, well, not different, you're going in the same direction, but it's wonderful how you...
Yeah, look, I just find it exciting, especially the writing process. I really enjoy. I love playing to audiences. So the only drag is the logistics of putting everything together. And I'm doing one band live show, as it happens, you know, the evening tonight that we're talking, and it's just a lot of logistics to do that. So the downside of things is that I want to do the live stuff, but it kind of eats up so much time when I could be doing something else. But I don't know, what is Michael, I what else would I do with myself? You know, I'd watch a lot of football anyway, so I'll keep doing that.
And, I don't mention football, Terry. terrible weekend over in the morning. So just to finish, I'm always fascinated to know about people's writing processes. I mean, as banal as, you know, do you use a pencil on a pad or a biro, or do you sit at a laptop, or do you sit at a big PC, or do you do it on your iPhone? I mean, how do you do it?
Okay, well, the process usually works. Let's say a novel. What's the process of a novel? And it varies. I can't say that it's always the same. But at some point, it starts with a big idea for me, which might be a what if. And I go, oh, for example, you know, we talked about Summer of Blood. And so the idea was, what if John Gordon and Ray Shearer solved the biggest unsolved crime, most famous crime in American crime history? How could they possibly do that? And when could they do that? And why wouldn't we know that they'd solved it? And then I went, well, okay, when could they do that? Oh, I've always wanted to do something with hippies and Haight Ashbury. So that's what I call the big idea. So from that point, and it could take months, sometimes I write this down in a paragraph and I don't come back to it for 10 years, but if I'm too busy with other stuff. But from that point, I set about thinking things. That's often just notes, a few notes, longhand, scrawled with biro on a pad. Do this, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, could do that. And then the next real stage that I do is I set, and probably this is the defining thing in terms of the eventual product. I sit down and I just try and knock up about 15 or 20 major pieces or major points, like a fishbone, you know, that could happen through the course of that story from beginning to end. And then I go away and I might develop those more, or I might just start writing and see how it goes. Now that what happens in there will change, will get fleshed out. Sometimes they're big changes, sometimes small, but generally I know where I'm starting and I know where I'm going in the middle and I know where I'm going at the end, but exactly how I get there may change. And the ending itself, the very specific ending, is quite likely to change 3 or 4 times because I might go, nah, that's too easy or too corny, or, you know, so.
It keeps playing in your mind and you know it when you get there, I take it. Dave Warner, it's been lovely chatting with you yet again. This is a great read, Summer of Blood. Did that title come to you quickly and easily?
Yeah, it did. It was a bit of a fluke. I just think Summer of Love, Summer of Blood, yeah. So.
It had to be. Congratulations and enjoy being back in the West.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, I love it. Still home for me. And I miss it. And it's really funny, Michael. Like, just in the mornings, I went for a walk this morning. I'm staying down at Melville, so I just went past the river there near Tompkins Park. And autumn morning, we've had those lovely hot nights and stuff, but it was quite chilly and cold. And the smell, you know, it took me straight back to, I'm putting the football socks and football boots on before, you know, you run out to play a game of footy. And it was great. It was a real joy because I loved that time, loved that thing. And And those things, they're always part of you. And the same thing, I mean, as soon as you step off the plane and you step into that light, that really harsh West Australian light, you know, yep, back home.
Well, all of your fans, all of the readers are going to look forward to your next two books, as well as this one.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks.
Okay. See you next time.